This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, folks. Welcome to the New Books Network. I am Emily Allen, your host for this episode. This is just a content warning for listeners that this interview does discuss possibly traumatic subject matter pertaining to rape. A little bit more about our guest, Steve Bergsman, one of the authors of Chapel of Love, the story of New Orleans girl group, the Dixie Cups, co-authored with Rosa Hawkins and published by the University Press of Mississippi in 2021. In 1963, sisters Barbara Ann and Rosa Hawkins and their cousin Joan Marie Johnson traveled from the segregated South to New York City under the auspices of their manager, former pop singer Joe Jones. With their wonderful harmonies, they were an immediate success. To this day, the Dixie Cups' greatest hit, Chapel of Love, is considered one of the best songs of the past 60 years. Chapel of Love, the story of New Orleans girl group, the Dixie Cups, explores the ups and downs of one of the most successful girl groups of the 1960s. Telling their story for the first time, in their own words, Chapel of Love reintroduces the Louisiana Music Hall of Famers to a new audience. Our guest, Steve Bergsman, is a longtime journalist who has written over a dozen books. His most recent book was a biography of Screamin' Jay Hawkins. And so, welcome, Steve.
How you doing?
Excellent. Pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
Yeah, looking forward to our chat, and I think our listeners will enjoy as well learning more about this very interesting book. So before we get into that part of the conversation, though, can you tell our listeners more about you and where you're coming from with this project, and can you tell us more about the Dixie Cups?
Sure. So as far as I'm concerned about me, subject that I know something about. So for the past 30 years or so, I was mostly a business and financial writer and travel writer. So I did that I was a freelance journalist, traveled the world. I had a specialty in real estate. So I interviewed I knew all the famous real estate people, from Donald Trump to Steve Ross, who develops in Manhattan. And then somewhere along the line, I was always an amateur musicologist, and I just decided to write something different. So after, I don't remember now, about five books on real estate, one of which was actually a bestseller. I decided to write about the early days of pop music going back to the 1950s. And I've done, I did a three-book set called the R&B set, and that was historical nonfiction. And then I moved over to nonfiction. Let me go back. That was historical fiction. And then I moved back to nonfiction. And I just published a couple of books. One was on Screamin' Jay Hawkins, the fellow who wrote I Put a Spell on You, a song that seems to live forever. And then I moved over to the Dixie Cups. Now, the story of the Dixie Cups. So let me tell you how I got to writing about the Dixie Cups. I was writing a book with Beverly Lee of the Shirelles. Now, up until the Supremes in the mid-60s, the Shirelles were the premier girl group of their time. They had their first hit record in 58, and then in the early 60s, they had wonderful songs like Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow and Soldier Boy, number one songs dedicated to the one I love. So they were the premier girl group, and there's two of them still alive. There were four of them. So I wrote, I think we called it Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow, the story of the Shirelles by Beverly Lee and Steve Bergsman. And that book was finished and put out to market. And then Beverly Lee sort of got cold feet and turned down every offer. And the book ended up never seeing the light of day, though it's still there and it's finished. And at some point she may say, oh, well, let's get this thing published. And I keep waiting for that day. But anyway, in the course of that, I decided to interview about a handful of people who were friendly with her and knew her. And two of those people were Rosa Hawkins and Barbara Hawkins of the Dixie Cups. And they were glad to speak because by the time the Dixie Cups came along, the Shirelles were old professionals from the road. And in those days, you did your record and then you went on the road as part of a group tour because there were all the, you know, today you'll see some famous act and they're the headliners, and there may be one opening act, but it's generally that. But back in, starting in the 40s, 50s, the tours were like 12 or 15 groups, and you'd sing one or two songs off the stage. Next famous person came in, sang one or two songs off the stage, and they toured by bus around the country. And by the time the Dixie Cups joined these tours, the Shirelles had been at it for about 4 years already, so they knew the ropes, and they instructed the Dixie Cups on how, what to wear, what foods to bring, et cetera, et cetera. Sometimes especially the Dick Clark tours, they toured the South, and these were white and black acts on the bus. But in the South, everything was segregated at the time. So it was often a difficult circumstance. So that's how I got involved with the Dixie Cups, because I interviewed them for the Beverly Lee Shirelles book. And then afterwards, Rosa Hawkins came to me. She called me up and said, no, I'd like to do a book. Now, I knew the Dixie Cups and I knew Chapel of Love and some of their other hits, but I wasn't too sure that after the trouble I had with Beverly Lee and the Trail, I wasn't too sure I wanted to go into another girl group book. And I said, okay, you got these hits, but what's your story? Why would this be interesting? And then Rosa proceeded to tell me this a very long story about how the Dixie Cups were abused. And in Rosa's case, she was not only were the Dixie Cups managerially abused and financially abused, but in Rose's case, she was physically abused. So that's sort of, I thought that, well, that was pretty interesting, and maybe it warranted a book. So I said, okay, we'll give it a shot. We'll do a chapter, and I'll put together a proposal, and we'll see if anybody is interested in this book. And the University of Mississippi Press, which excels in books about music history, that's pretty much their forte. They wanted the book, and so we got it underway. So this is a story about the Dixie Cups, who had a very short life in pop history. Their songs, oddly enough, lived forever, but as a recording act, they only had a short life. They toured forever as well, but it's a long story of what I call abuse and obsession, because even years after they were able to separate from their manager, a man named Joe Jones, who back in 1960 had a big hit called "You Talk Too Much." It was a number two record in the country. Could never find a follow-up and continue on in the recording industry doing other things. And he discovered the Dixie Cups and managed them and siphoned away all their money, among other things. And even after the Dixie Cups were finally able to separate from him, he spent decades tormenting them and trying to sue them and trying to claim all their records. Even the name of the group was his, and that went on for a very, very long time. So that's sort of the overview of the Dixie Cups and me.
Yeah, thank you for laying that out for our listeners. I think that is, like you said, a very great overview of everything. And I wanted to back up sort of to what you were just talking about towards the end there, which is this relationship between Joe Jones and the Dixie Cups and his abuse of different forms. To your knowledge, had this really been discussed much before this book? You know, and what was it like for you to, you know, talk with Rosa and work through this with Rosa and looking back at those experiences?
So Rosa carried this story her whole life, because all the Dixie Cups were financially abused and managerially abused, but Rosa was physically abused as well. In fact, she was raped. So we'll go out and say that. And she never talked about it. But, you know, they're getting on in years, and I think Rosa that carried the story long enough, and she felt it was something she wanted to finally put out there. So, I think that's why she came to me to write this book. So she wanted to tell this very long and very tough story for her. So I always thought she was very brave and finally coming around to tell this story. So I'll just give you a brief history how this all started. So New Orleans was a very potent music town forever. And everybody thinks of it as sort of a jazz town, because pretty much jazz was created there in the early 20th century. But it was also a premier town for the creation of rock and roll. Everybody think, oh, rock and roll, New York, places in the Northeast. But one of the nodes for the creation of rock and roll was New Orleans. And that was because one of the earliest recording studios in the South was in New Orleans. And it was it was created around 1948. So a lot of the itinerant musicians, blues musicians, R&B singers who toured the South and the Midwest, they came down to New Orleans to record. Plus, there was an infrastructure there. There was a lot of talent there. New Orleans had some of the best clubs for R&B musicians in the country. So It was a place where music got started. And even into the end of the 50s, 60s, there were still a lot of musicians that recorded or came to New Orleans to record there. One of them was Joe Jones, who was a New Orleans musician. And he began, a lot of things Joe Jones said never really made sense. He claimed he was on the recording session for the seminal pre-rock and roll, proto-rock and roll song, Good Rockin' Tonight. But according to my research, he was still in the Navy, so that didn't happen. But he did tour with a very good New Orleans early rock and rollers, Shirley and Lee. And their famous song from the mid-50s was Let the Good Times Roll. But they had a lot of songs before that. A very, very good group, underappreciated. So, and then he started recording, and he had the song You Talk Too Much, a very a novelty song, but it was successful. And never able to find a follow-up, and so he just hung around in New Orleans, and he was looking for talent to sort of promote and manage. And he was at a talent contest. New Orleans famous for their talent contests for youngsters. And he came across a group called the Meltones. And the Meltones was mostly put together with Barbara Hawkins and her friend, another female, and two males. And then one of the males, singers, couldn't make it. His mother got sick and he had to drop out, and they needed a fourth because a lot of doo-wop was either four or five people. So they wanted a fourth. And they needed a singer to take the place of the male, and they couldn't find one. And Barbara suggested her sister, Rosa, and because Rosa had a deeper voice. So that was the formation of the Meltones. They sang at the talent contest, and Joe Jones discovered them. Now, I got to tell you that Rosa was still in high school or just graduating high school. She was a very, she was a teenager, and the other two were teenagers also. Barbara was the oldest. She was about 19 at this point, but Rosa was about 16. So when all of this began to happen, and Joe Jones calls up somebody he knew that he toured with in the early 50s. I can't think of his name now. Love is Strange, the duo that sang Love is Strange. And the female, part of that duo, she was in New York, and she was also looking around to do other things, and she would become a very famous music executive and publisher with her own company called All Platinum, which published and created the first popular rap record. So, but she got her start in the 50s singing Love is Strange. Oh, Mickey and Sylvia. And her, when she founded All Platinum a decade later, she was Sylvia Robinson. So anyway, he calls Mickey, he calls Sylvia, says, I found this group, the Meltones. I think they're talented. I want to bring them to New York and see if we can get a recording contract. And he gets permission from their mother, and he also gets, since he's an adult and they're underage, he has parental control over them as well. Now the girls, they're teenagers, and here's where everything goes wrong for the girls, and they didn't know it, is that when you're the talent, you hire your management, so you're in control. You're the talent. But they were teenagers; they didn't know anything, and they always assumed that their manager, Joe Jones, was in control of them. So whatever Joe Jones said or did, plus he was the only adult in this whole thing, they subscribed to whatever he was proclaiming. So they go to New York, and he takes them, and you literally hit the pavement, you walk around, you visit. There are hundreds of songwriters in New York and little companies that were out there. And many of them were located in two buildings on Broadway. The most famous is the Brill Building. And the Brill Building was really not a high rise, a mid rise. And it was located just off Broadway. It was on Broadway, I'm sorry. It was right on Broadway. And it was a warren of little offices, and songwriters, all the famous songwriters out of the 60s, the Carole Kings, the Ellie Greenwiches, all of them, they all worked there, and there were little publishing companies. And so he eventually makes his, Joe Jones eventually brings him to the Brill Building, and they're visiting this office and this office and this office. And he takes him in to see Ellie Greenwich. And a lot of the female songwriters were married to their songwriting partners, such as Carole King. She was married to her songwriting partner, and so was Ellie Greenwich. And they said, okay, let's hear what you got. And they had this song that they sung for everybody, which was written by a friend down in New Orleans. And they sounded interesting, and they sounded interesting because most of the girl group sound, which evolved out of the doo-wop sound, consisted of a forward, a lead singer, and generally three backup singers who would do the fill. So that's the way doo-wop was. And when the girl groups got started, such as the Shirelles, and almost every girl group after that was a lead singer, and the follow-up, Martha and the Vandellas, or the Supremes, even the Supremes with Diana Ross did that. But the Dixie Cups were different. They had a group sound. They had three-part harmony, which was what they sang. Their mother was a singer, and they sang with their mother in church, and they all sang in this harmony. So what impressed Ellie was the fact that these girls had this three-part harmony, which was a different sound. And all the writers had a lot of stuff, what they called in the can. They'd write a song, somebody would sing it, maybe they get it to a girl group, and it would be sung, maybe it wasn't hit, but nothing ever got wasted. So, in fact, the song, Chapel of Love, was tried by Phil Spector. Phil Spector was the third writing partner of this song. So he had his own groups he liked to, girl groups that he liked to deal with. And he tried a few times to have them sing Chapel of Love, and nothing ever came of it. So enter the Dixie Cups, and Ellie and her husband, they take down, the name escapes him at the moment, but he was a principal part of the writing group. They take the song down and they play it for the Dixie Cups, and they say, could you do something with this Chapel of Love song? And the Dixie Cups didn't really quite like it, but they said, sure, we'll do something with it. So they left the song with her, with the Dixie Cups, went away, came back 20 minutes later. The Dixie Cups have rearranged it now in three-part harmony. They sing it. The songwriters go, oh, wow, this is great. And we're going to record you. So they sign the contract, and onward and upward for the Dixie Cups. Now, a lot of, as you know, a lot of acts, they come, they cut an, nowadays they cut an album or a few songs. But back in the day, you cut a record, a 45, A side, B side, and you put it out there, and hopefully got discovered. And sometimes you may cut 12 records or 14 records, and you wouldn't make it. Or maybe on your 15th record, you finally had a hit. But the Dixie Cups, on their very first try, Chapel of Love was their very first recording, and it was a monster. It was a number one hit. So they got very lucky. And then came the tours and the recording and everything else. And so you wonder, okay, how did they get mismanaged there? I mean, Joe Jones discovered them, brought them to New York. They recorded a record. So what happened after that? Well, a couple of things. So Joe Jones, his only source of income was the Dixie Cups. So whatever the Dixie Cups made money, if they did, they got money for the recording, if they went on tour and did shows, he made money. So he put the Dixie Cups in an apartment, 3-in-1 apartment, and he took apartment a couple of floors up in the same building. All this money is coming out of the Dixie Cups. His life, he bought a car so he could take them around. That money's coming out of the Dixie Cups. And in fact, the Dixie Cups never, ever had any money. They just got an allowance from their manager, Joe Jones. They were teenagers. They completely put their life in Joe Jones' hands. So, you know, any money that came into the Dixie Cups came into Joe Jones first, and he took off out all his expenses. And as things got bigger for the Dixie Cups, and there was royalties and all that, Joe Jones would go down to the music publisher, the company that produced the record, and say, the Dixie Cups need an advance. They want to send some money home to their mother, and the company would give Joe Jones an advance on future royalties. But Joe Jones, that money never went to the Dixie Cups. That money always went to Joe Jones. So he was actually taking money from the Dixie Cups the whole time, and they never knew it. When at some point in the future, when they went to get their royalties for Chapel of Love, which probably sold 2 million records, their take was $700 a piece, and they go, you know, they thought they were going to get thousands and thousands. And then they learned that Joe Jones would be going and saying, hey, you know, we need an advance on future royalties. I need an advance on future royalties. So he was, in fact, taking all their money, plus supporting Joe Jones's lifestyle. So that's how it all started for them. Plus, they were totally controlled by Joe Jones, even though they were actually in control because they were the talent, but they didn't know it. They thought the manager controlled them. And if they did something he didn't like, he would always threaten to fire him, but he couldn't fire him. But they didn't know that. They always thought Joe Jones could fire one of them, et cetera, et cetera. And so there are a number of stories about Joe Jones abusing his management of the Dixie Cups. And so I'm just going to tell you two, because there's many. So the Dixie Cups' career as a recording act only lasted about a year. And that was because while he was in New Orleans, the Dixie Cups were in a recording studio one day. And it was downtime, and they were bored. And just to pass the time, they started singing an old New Orleans chant that their mother had taught them. And that chant is now called Ico Ico. So they're sitting in the studio, and they're banging on Pepsi bottles and whatever is there, and the three of them, and they're having a good time. And then they didn't know that the record producer was listening, and he was recording it. He liked it so much, he recorded the girls having a good time. And that record, and they recorded it. And what you hear in the hit record, Ico Ico, is actually the girls just playing around in the recording studio. They added just one instrument after that and nothing else. And it became also a big hit. And the record company quickly, because they didn't trust Joe Jones, the record company didn't even trust Joe Jones, they quickly got the rights to, made the record, the rights to the creation of the record, they put it in the Dixie Cups name. So the three girls, Rosa, Barbara, and the cousin, all three of them got the rights to the song Ico Ico. Joe Jones comes back. He says, no, I created that song. I it was my song. I want the rights to that. Because he wanted the royalty rights, the future royalty rights. And then the record company said no. He got into a fight with them, and he took the Dixie Cups to another publisher. Well, he couldn't do that because they were under contract. So they went to another publisher, and then it became a legal fight, and they... Turns out that Dixie Cups couldn't record anymore for the new company. They couldn't record anymore for the old company. And they were no longer a recording act and then became a touring act at that point. So, but now I'm going to tell you the worst story. So they were very popular, the Dixie Cups, for a long time. And a lot of the hits they recorded on Redbird Records, and these companies strung out their hits over time. So even though they weren't recording, you know, some of the records kept coming out, and they were very popular, and they toured England twice. And on this one particular trip to England, Joe Jones is out. He's buying up the town. He's buying everything he wants to take back to New York. And meanwhile, the Dixie Cups, they get to hang out at night with the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and they're just having a good time in London. And finally, it's all over, and they're in the airport with Joe Jones expecting to go home when the police come and arrest Joe Jones. It turns out that Joe Jones buying up the town, buying thousands of dollars worth of goods in London, writing checks, and he had no money in his checking account. So he's kiting these checks, hoping that he can get out of England fast enough that when people realize there was no money behind these checks, he would already be in New York and he wouldn't get caught because nobody's going to bring him back to that. So he was kiting checks, but the British merchants were quicker than he realized, and he's arrested. Now, the Dixie Cups, they're still essentially wards of, in their minds, they're wards of Joe Jones, and they're at the airport and they don't know what to do. So they think, who do we know here? Well, the year before, they had toured with The Animals, a group called The Animals, a very popular British group, their biggest hit being The House of the Rising Sun, a number one hit in the U.S. And they were friendly with the Animals, and they said, oh, we know these guys. Let's call them. Maybe they could help us. And the lead singer of the group was a fellow by the name of Eric Burdon. And they eventually get in touch with Eric Burdon. He says, don't worry about it. Go to this address, take a taxi to this address. It's my apartment. There's a key there. You guys can stay there. I will get my lawyer to get Joe Jones out of jail. So Eric Byrd does this amazing favor for them, and they're staying in his apartment. The lawyer, I guess, barrister, is that what? I don't think they call him lawyers in London. Maybe it was his barrister. Anyway, he does his job and he gets Joe Jones out of jail. And Joe Jones goes to Eric's apartment because that's where the Dixie Cups are staying, and he's going to stay there the next night, and hopefully in a day or two, they can get out of Britain. So he's out of jail. He's all puffed up with himself. I did jail. I'm out. I can do what I want. And he's like the king of the roost, and the Dixie Cups. They're serving him dinner. They're giving him a drink, whatever he wants. They're like three servants to him. And there's only one bed. The three girls are sharing one huge bed. And Joe Jones is supposed to sleep out on the couch. But he gets restless and goes into the girls' room. And he starts, climbs into the bed next to Rosa Hawkins. And he starts handling her. And she pushes him away. But he's back. And I think it's, I'm not sure what's called it, statutory rape or rape. But anyway, he has his way with Rosa Hawkins. And the thing about Rosa Hawkins, and probably the reason she wrote this book, is that she entered this life right out of high school. She never really had a boyfriend. She never experienced, boyfriend life or, passionately kissed a boy in high school. She just went from high school life to becoming a Dixie Cup and a star. And she never, even those years, she never really had a boyfriend. So she was just a girl who was a singer. And Joe Jones comes and has his way with her. So, and they're very religious, the girls. So, this was a terrible thing. And as Rosa, as she says in the book, and this is the story she said, that the next night she said she'd sleep on the couch because she didn't want to be harassed by Joe. And Joe joined the other two sleeping in the big bed. But she said she got a kitchen knife and sat up all night with a kitchen knife, just in case Joe Jones would come back to her again. So, but anyway, they get out of England, and the Dixie Cups say, they're back in New York, and they say to Joe, okay, we need to pay back Eric Burden's lawyer. And Joe Jones says, no, I'm not paying him back. I'm here in the U.S. I'm not paying him back. Forget that. And he never even thanks Eric Burden for the help he got and the Dixie Cups got, and never paid Eric back for the time that his lawyer helped him get out of England. So, and by this time, the girls are so cowed Joe Jones has a wife and family in New Orleans and a girlfriend that lives with him in New York. But he would come down. He had a key to the girl's apartment, Dixie Cup's apartment. And he would come down and two of the girls slept in a bedroom. It was one bedroom. And Rosa slept on a pullout couch in the living room. And then he would come down every so often and have his way with Rosa whenever he wanted. And that's the terrible story of the beginning. That was just the time that they were together, because they eventually realized that they were in charge of Joe Jones, and they had to get rid of him. First, Joan Marie Johnson quit because she couldn't take him anymore, and she left and the Dixie Cups and went back to a normal life in New Orleans. But Barbara and Rosa plowed on with the other singers. There are many more stories and many more lawsuits because Joe Jones was so obsessed with them, he could not let them go. And he would try to strangle their act over the next decades. And there's many, many stories of his cruelty to the Dixie Cups over the years. So any questions after all that?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I was thinking about how really those stories that that Rosa and you helped her do in this book, and that retelling of this dynamic between Joe Jones and the group, and, you know, there's all this trauma that clearly they experienced to an extent with all that, obviously. It seems like the timing of this book is really significant too, right? Like thinking about like the Me Too movement that's happened over the last few years. Can you talk maybe a little bit about that in terms of, you know, how readers might kind of situate this book within this recent movement? And also, again, this happened, you know, kind of these two historical moments here, right? Between what clearly happened to the Dixie Cups and then these things that have happened with like different artists, especially women, in the last few years.
So in a sense, the story of the Dixie Cups is unusual, but not out of the ordinary, because a lot of the girl groups, they were all very young when they started out, and they were all, and a lot of them were Black, and Black performers were abused in many different ways over the years, and the stories are legendary, from Billie Holiday going forward. So this even happened in the 60s, and I think you probably find there are some stories even now of female acts where they're abused by their management, maybe not physically like Rosa was, but certain managerially, and probably and to some extent financially. And you know, look at Britney Spears. I mean, that's a little different story, but has she been in control of her life all these years? No. So it's hard for females. It was always hard for female singers, and more power to those who realize that they were the power in any relationship, and it's time they realized it. So you said of the Me Too movement, but there's like a sector of the Me Too movement for entertainers. So you gotta give some credence and snaps to somebody like Taylor Swift, who sort of took back her professional life, and the other singers that have that have done so. But it's a long history of this in the industry. And we're just looking at the recording industry, but it's probably no different in the, say, the movie industry as well. The old casting, quote unquote, casting couch kind of thing.
Yeah. And, you know, that helps a lot with kind of, again, like I said, contextualizing this book sort of in this moment that it's come out too. And going back to sort of, again, this book is giving Rosa that voice, right, to express these things. And I wanted to hear a little bit more too about some of the behind the scenes aspects of this, right? So with you and Rosa, what was sort of this process like of working together on putting this book out? Like, what was sort of the process like with the interviews? You know, what was sort of this dialogue like with you two?
So the way I do it when I work with somebody that is going to do a book, and in this case, I have to take a step back. I have to make this Rose's book. So it's always the singer with say Steve Bergsman, and that's the way I did it with Beverly Lee, and I actually did it with another singer as well. And the way I do it, I try to make it as easy as possible for them. They really never have to write a word. All they have to do is talk to me. So first of all, they have to trust me to talk to me. So thankfully they do. My wife always jokes that I'm the girl group whisperer because they're my friends forever. Thankfully, I say. So they trust me enough to talk to me. And I realize they have a story to tell, and but I don't want them to rush it. So I try to limit all the interviews, and I'll use this book as my case study. So I limit all my interviews to just 1 hour. I only do 1 hour interviews. Because sometimes my questions are very in depth, and I need to get them thinking in depth. Even you and I, if we were doing a book, we'd sort of have these highlights that they're stories that we tell over and over again, it's like gloss. We just tell this story, and there's a punchline, it's over. But there's a lot of depth to that story that we don't tell. That's not our highlight that we tell. So I need to get very deep into what's behind the story. So I only do 1 hour. If they want to do 2 hour, another interview in the week, that's fine. But I will only limit the interview to a second hour. A lot of them just like to do one interview a week. Fine, there's no rush to this. I just, it's time to get the story out. And once we do a couple of these 1 hour interviews, Rosa and other singers that I've interviewed, they understand the process. And they get eventually they get more talkative because they know that I'm trying to get the story behind that little highlight film that they're showing, and that's my process. So there's actually two steps. A, they have to accept you as a writer, and then once they do that, then they have to accept you as the interviewer. And if you get that, then you have magic. And in the case of the Dixie Cups, we got that magic because Rosa had a story to tell, right? And she really wanted to tell it. She didn't know how to tell it, but we were able to get the whole story out.
Yeah. And was there anything sort of in that process and in, you know, the various things that you all discussed that maybe surprised you? What did you kind of learn in doing that process?
Well, I learned a lot about the Dixie Cups, and I learned a lot about, I was always aware of all the mismanagement and abuse, but I never really heard it firsthand and how difficult this all was. Now, let me go back when I did the book with Beverly Lee of the Shirelles, she too had a rape story, and she couldn't tell me the story. So we continued. I let it go, and then we're getting towards the end of all the interviews and the book, and it took her really to almost to the last interview to tell me the story. And so she finally got it out. Now, you might ask, you know, why isn't this book in print? I don't know. I maybe she still has some ambiguity about having this story out there, because it really took a lot for her to tell me that story. And it's in the book, but maybe she doesn't want to see it, or doesn't want anybody else to see it.
Right. It's one of those types of experiences that, you know, it's a lot to grapple with, like you're saying, as to whether something like that, you know, even though we're talking about in the case of this book, something like that being open, it's, you know, a different case for everyone for sure.
Yeah. So these incidents, you know, happened 50 years ago. And I sort of feel bad because, you know, they've been carrying this within them for so long and probably tormenting them to some extent. You know, that incident has tormented them. And thankfully, in Rose's case, she was able to, I think it helped her to tell this story and get it out there. She really wanted to get it out there. I don't think she has a one boy, and I'm not sure her son knew it, but she, before she did the book, she had a discussion with her son and said, there's some things I have to say that what might make you uncomfortable. So he said, you know, go ahead and do it. So I think she got sort of an imprimatur from her son to go ahead and write this book. And that helped her also.
Got it. Well, thank you, Steve, for, you know, helping us understand this book and this very important, again, these important stories that you have helped the Dixie Cups tell. As we start finishing up, I want to ask you, was there anything else about the book that we haven't already touched on that you think our listeners should understand?
Well, I think a lot of people would see this book and say, oh, Dixie Cups, it's a girl group. Do we need another memoir or biography about something, you know, a group from so many years ago? But as you so rightly pointed out, their story fits into that whole Me Too movement nexus. So this is actually a story that's important now, even though her story was from 50 years ago, it fits right into what's happening now. And I think people should look at the book because, as you said, some things never change.
Yeah, very good point. And thank you so much for talking with us today on the New Books Network. And I'll go to what's my usual closing question. What else are you working on right now?
Oh, I'm so busy. I have a book coming out next year, Texas A&M Press, on three R&B pioneers who died young under controversial circumstances. So that's coming out. And then I'm really proud of this. It's a two-book set on the female singers of the 1950s. And it's a two-book set because the first book is on the white singers and the second book is on the black singers. And it's in two different books because they have different arcs. The white singers had one arc that was very, very different from the black singers of the time. And I think the University of Mississippi Press is going to take those two.
Cool. Well, I will look forward to checking those out. And thank you so much for talking with us today.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. And listeners, just to remind you, you just heard an interview with Steve Bergsman, one of the authors of Chapel of Love, the story of New Orleans girl group The Dixie Cups, co-authored with Rosa Hawkins, and published by the University Press of Mississippi in 2021. This is your host, Emily Allen, and I will see you next time here on the New Books Network.